Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Leadership books are a dime a dozen. It's a well-worn genre, often not worthy of much more than an eye roll and a yawn. But when a person who's led international institutions, whose decisions meant the difference between life and death for thousands, when that person writes a book about leadership and puts honesty and humility at the center of the book, well, perhaps it's time to take notice. James DeVries is a retired four-star admiral of the United States Navy. He served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. He led the U.S. Southern Command. He commanded a Navy destroyer, a squadron, and an aircraft battle group. He's also the former dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And in his new book, he tells the story of 10 admirals from history who've inspired him and the lessons he's learned from their lives. So this hour on Point, James DeVries and the difference between leadership and character. And you can join us. What do you think makes for a great leader? What is your question for James DeVries and the high and low points of his own life and what lessons those have taught him? And James DeVries joins us today from New York. His new book is Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. Admiral DeVries, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Let's get underway.
Let's get underway. You heard my dig there at leadership books as a whole.
Could not agree with you more. We are awash in leadership books. And this, I really want to underline the subtitle, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character, because there's a real difference between leadership and character. Leadership is the influence we exert over others. Character is how we lead ourselves. It's that inner voyage, which I would argue is much trickier navigationally than simple leadership.
Mm-hmm. And you go into detail about the character of the 10 admirals that you pick from history here. But before I fully get past my dig at leadership books, I am curious, why did you wanted to write this book now?
Because I feel there is, in fact, a dearth of thinking about character. Mm-hmm. Again, we see the effects today of leadership being magnified by these endless, powerful technical tools, social networks, the immediacy of thought, the acceleration, complete transparency. But there are very few books written and very few conversations about character, about how we decide what is right and what is wrong, about how we empathize with others, about how we find common ground with our adversaries. So as I was observing the American political scene 2-3 years ago and the increasing acrimony, I thought, let's write a book about character.
Okay. Now, is there something in particular about the role that an admiral plays that you think can highlight or does highlight this question of what makes for character?
Well, the reason I chose a series of admirals to kind of paint this picture, really two reasons. One, for every writer out there, write about what you know. And so having spent a lifetime reading and studying and learning about those who preceded me in command at sea, those who have had that experience of being a flag officer at sea and leading ships and men and women into combat, it was a logical place for me to frame the conversation. And then secondly, Meghna, I think there is something about the sea itself that lends itself to thinking about character as follows. The other day, I just for the heck of it, I added up, got out all my logbooks and added up all the days I spent at sea on the deep ocean, out of sight of land, about 9.5 years. And I felt that all that time at sea, looking at that horizon, it is a contemplative environment. And I think that as a result, sailors, not just Navy men and women, but sailors, those who go to the sea are predisposed to think about those kind of internal voyages. And so I thought I'd try and communicate that as well in the book.
Mm. Okay. Well, so let's talk about some of these admirals then that you've chosen. Some are familiar names. We've got Horatio Nelson in there, for example, Francis Drake as well. But you start way back in history with a Greek admiral. Tell us about Themistocles.
Pretty close. Themistocles. You got it at the back.
Okay.
You got it on the backflip. First of all, I'm Greek-American, so it would be hard for me not to include a famous Greek. Secondly, Themistocles wins what is arguably the greatest battle in ancient Greek history. This is the Battle of Salamis, which is a bay off the coast of Athens, where Themistocles, with really a very undermanned force of Greek galleys, defeats a massive Persian fleet and stops the invasion of Greece by Persia. Had he lost that battle, the entire strain of history that flows from that moment, I think, would have been very different. And he wins that battle, by the way, not only with the strength of the oarsmen rowing these galleys, but also with his own ability to inspire, which derives from his character. And so for me, he was a very logical choice, although not terribly well known.
Okay. And then the lessons that you draw from his career and his life?
As usual, there's both good and bad.
Yeah.
He is someone who has the power to communicate. He's extremely inspirational, extremely charismatic. But we discover after he wins this iconic battle and becomes a great leader within Athenian society, over time, his arrogance gets the better of him. His sense of ego gets the better of him. And eventually, he's driven out of Athens. And here's an extremely ironic turn in his life. He achieves sanctuary with the Persians and ends up dying in Persia. So it's a tale of power to inspire because of the charisma that you have in your character, but also a cautionary tale of how you should not let your ego overwhelm your abilities, which is what happened to Themistocles eventually.
Right. It seems as if many of these admirals that you've chosen, their lives and careers do present a double-edged sword of sorts.
Absolutely. And you could really walk down the list and find both good and bad in almost all of these, which is true for each of us, right?
Yeah. So let's jump ahead to one of my personal favorite figures from history, and that's Nelson, Horatio Nelson, of course. Very well known to anyone who cares about naval history, but why did you put Nelson in this group?
Well, first of all, just as I'm Greek-American, I'm also not a very tall person. I'm about 5 feet, 5 inches on a really good day. And you may not know this about Lord Nelson, Vice Admiral Nelson, arguably the greatest fighting admiral in history, by the way. He was exactly my height, 5 feet, 5 inches tall. So I kind of sympathize with him. Secondly, he is so intriguing in his innate ability to bring teams together. He's the ultimate team builder. We all love Doris Kearns Goodwin's marvelous book, Team of Rivals, by her about Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. Nelson evinces those same qualities. He can bring people together. He creates this band of brothers out of all of his frigate captains. Together, they become an invincible force at sea. He wins battle after battle. And then tragically, at the height of his popularity as well as the height of his military abilities at the Battle of Trafalgar, he defeats a combined French and Spanish fleet but is tragically shot on the quarterdeck of his massive flagship, HMS Victory, and comes home to great heroism and a wonderful sense of the nation that now adores him, but he has sailed on the flood tide. It's a powerful story.
That's right. I mean, he wins the battle but loses his life in the process.
He does. And of course, here, if we look at flaws, and we have to, despite I'm with you, I think he is in many ways the greatest admiral in history. But he was an adulterer. He was involved in a famous love triangle. He stole a beautiful Emma Hamilton away from her husband, had a child out of wedlock. He was also kind of a publicity hound. He always wanted to generate the headlines. So as always, it's kind of a mixed picture. But in his case, his fundamental patriotism, his fundamental empathetic compassion for his captains at sea really put him near the top of the list.
Is this one of the lessons that you draw from the collective stories of these admirals, that when one rises to a particular level as a leader, there comes with it this incredible pull of entitlement or the possibility of even justified arrogance, and that character requires pushing those away?
You say it precisely right. I often say at the top of the mountain, the strongest winds blow. And to stand in those winds and not be figuratively blown into the chaos of your ego and your arrogance, you have to remain grounded, if you will, at the top of that mountain. Some of these admirals do that better than others. And to jump, if I could, to an American admiral who did that very well, it would be Chester Nimitz, Fleet Admiral Nimitz. He was a five-star admiral. We only give out that five-star rank in the U.S. Armed Forces during times of war. So Eisenhower was a general of the armies, a five-star. Nimitz was a fleet admiral, a five-star admiral. And the thing to know about Nimitz is he absolutely shows us resilience, taking command of the fleet just as Pearl Harbor happens. The ships are smoking in the harbor in front of him. He beats the Japanese, he wins World War II, and remains completely grounded through the rest of his life. He's an extraordinary figure of humility.
Well, we're talking this hour with Admiral James Stavridis. He's got a new book out. It's called Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Admiral James Stavridis. He is a retired four-star admiral, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, a position he served between 2009 and 2013. And he has a new book out. It's called Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character, where he talks about leadership and character and lessons learned from the life stories of 10 admirals from history. Now, Admiral Stavridis, we can't talk about lessons regarding character and leadership without also taking a look at your own career here. And I do want to ask you specifically about something that you honestly grapple with in the book. And that is the fact that in 2011 and 2012, right in the middle of your time as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, the DOD's Inspector General looked into allegations on your about your very own leadership, right? That you had used military flights for non-NATO or non-military purposes, that you had allegedly accepted gifts or reimbursements and used government cellular telephones and transportation. Now, the Inspector General, I'm looking at a memorandum here from 2012, ultimately found that you never used your public office for private gain or committed any personal misconduct. But the conclusion was also that as commander, you were responsible for the administrative failures noted in the investigation. So talk to me about that.
I can. Seminal chapter in my life, you know, and we were talking earlier about the sense of how you behave when you're at the very pinnacle of your career. And everything was going very well for me. Supreme Allied Commander of NATO was a marvelous period in my life, a very challenging one in terms of my missions in Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, Syria, piracy, cyber operations, when these allegations emerged. And you know, I encourage people to step forward when they think something is going wrong. And there were a couple of people on my staff who had the feeling that some of the trips I was taking were not fully appropriate. So as is the case and ought to be the case, it was fully investigated. It was, I think, about a 9 to 10 month investigation. Ultimately, I was cleared. But your bottom line is correct. I was responsible for the administrative failings that led to the perception that we were doing something wrong, even though at the end of the day, I think the phrase the Secretary of the Navy used was that I was a model naval officer. Terrific. But I was still the commander who owned what the chain of command had not done appropriately. So it was a striking example to me of how you have to take responsibility in organizations. And you look at other senior military who have gone through similar things. General Dave Petraeus had an affair, was passing classified material to someone who was writing a biography of him. He was ultimately found guilty in court of a misdemeanor. General Stan McChrystal was relieved for cause after making disparaging comments about the president, although he was ultimately cleared personally. Same kind of situation.
You're not really – you're not comparing your situations to David Petraeus passing classified information.
No, I'm not. But I think – thank you. But I think it's worth noting that any leader, when you're at the top of an organization, has to be constantly self-examining and ensuring that – they are relentlessly doing the right thing. Well, and I think that was the lesson I took away.
So let me ask you, because you write in the book how this experience fundamentally reshaped your career and life. In looking through the prism of, you know, the examples of these admirals, was this point in your career, was it a failure of leadership or of character?
I would say more than anything, it was a failure of attention to detail. But I would put that down as, in the end, a failure of leadership, because a leadership requirement is that you're constantly scanning that horizon. You're looking at your subordinates. You're looking at your seniors, your peers. You're making sure that everything in the organization is running as it should be, and you own any mistakes or missteps that occur. From a character perspective, I know myself pretty well at this point in my life, and I know that I was not deliberately doing something which would have violated the norms that I hold so dear. Mm-hmm. So I would say more on the leadership side and a failure to ensure real attention to detail in administrative things, just as important as the operational things, because of the perceptions that can be generated if you fail.
Yeah, I wanted to pursue this for a little bit because I'm of the school of don't necessarily listen to what they say, look at what they do, Admiral.
Sure.
But let's go to the callers here. Let's go to Patrick, who's calling from Kent, Connecticut. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, you know, I just had a question. I'm not going to be able to listen to the entire show. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on Admiral Stockdale and his writings on ethics. and stoicism and how living a virtuous life can guide your character, you know, throughout the process, you know, of a leadership, and, you know, also how Stockdale, you know, he was picked on a lot, but was really, I really felt that his character just, you know, he guided that through as he fought hazing at the Citadel, and, you know, really just did a lot of works on ethics, trying to establish that character and leaders. And, you know, I'll go off the air and just listen to what he had to say. Thank you so much.
Patrick, thank you. And I will say immediately, I looked so hard to pick these 10 admirals, and Stockdale probably would have been the 11th admiral. He really is that good, and I thank you for raising his name. Just two thoughts to add to your very excellent summary. For the listeners, he was shot down over Vietnam as a Navy combat pilot, and as he was literally in the harness of the parachute going into Vietnam, recognizing he would be captured, tortured, interrogated, he began to recite to himself the words of the ancient Greeks, the Stoics that Patrick just referred to, because he knew he would have to draw on the deepest reserves of his character in order to survive what came ahead. He was tortured terribly, came back to the United States, and became an iconic figure in terms of ethics, morality, taught those at the Naval War College, was a candidate for vice president, you may recall. And the last thing I want to say about him as well is he and his wife, Sybil, wrote a marvelous book together, with Sybil writing a chapter about what it was like for her to be home alone, a single mother raising children while he was in a prison camp. Then you'd have a chapter from the Admiral, and it would go back and forth through their career and in particular their time of separation in Vietnam. It's called In Love and War by James and Sybil Stockdale, and it is a profile in character as well. Patrick, thank you for raising him.
Well, Admiral, we also have some folks who want to talk with you about pressing current day issues. So let's go to Ray, who's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I love the show. Admiral, I have a question in regards to the current situation in Syria with the United States pulling out troops there. Just with the influence of Russia and Iran, will that fill the vacuum, especially you knowing that area as a NATO commander? How is that going to affect the future, especially in that volatile area? And I almost, as a personal opinion, almost seems like the shooting of Archduke Ferdinand, that these things will just compound on themselves and keep going.
Ray, what an excellent question. Let me frame it historically in a certain sense that you may not have considered, although it really makes your point. What we're seeing unfolding before us is a clash of ancient empires. One could say this is the Ottoman Turks invading the heart of the Arab Caliphate. And what flutters around the edges? It's Persia, the Persian Empire, three ancient empires colliding in a very small battle space. It is also, as you correctly point out, creating a vacuum as the U.S. pulls out of it that will be filled, first and foremost, frankly, by Vladimir Putin and his surrogate, the war criminal dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, with assistance from the Iranians. So this is a situation that I think you are right to compare somewhat to the great power collision 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, one of the precipitating events of the First World War. The question is, how do we avoid that turn of events? Here I would argue this is a place where a very small deployment of U.S. forces can make a very big difference. To put the 2,000 to 3,000 troops we're talking about in perspective, when I commanded the NATO mission in Afghanistan, I had 150,000 troops. At peak in Iraq, we had 185,000 troops. We're talking 2,000 or 3,000 troops. Sometimes big doors swing on small hinges, and pulling that hinge out, that U.S. force, I think is a mistake we will come to rue.
Admiral, we're hearing or seeing reports of members of the U.S. military in Syria saying that for the first time in their lives, in their military careers, they are feeling ashamed about the decisions made by the commander-in-chief and the Pentagon. What's your thoughts about that?
It is true. And I have received personally over a dozen emails, phone calls, communications, particularly from special forces operators, both Navy SEALs and Army Green Berets, who were the heart of this force in northern Syria. And they say things like, how can we turn our back on our Kurdish allies? I had tea with these people. I visited their families in their homes. My interpreter was a Kurd who saved my life. And to see us simply walk away is just an enormous mistake. And let me put it in a historical perspective, Magna, if I can. Think about the Korean War and the Korean Peninsula in the early 1950s. If we had said then, you know, this is getting really bloody. We're all sick of these wars in Asia. You know, the Koreans weren't with us in Normandy. They weren't with us in World War II, as President Trump said about the Kurds. And we had just left, what would have happened? That peninsula would have turned into one enormous dystopian kingdom, reminiscent or reflecting Kim Jong-un in the north. And we would have given up, we the West would have given up South Korea, the 15th largest economy in the world, a strong military partner. There are good reasons to remain engaged, not with 150,000 troops, 185,000 troops, but a reasonable small deployment like this makes a lot of sense.
But Admiral, you know, it's interesting because, yes, we must learn from the lessons of history, whether it be the history of a past century or past millennia, right? I mean, but when I hear you talk, you had mentioned sort of the echoes of the Ottoman Empire. Totally understood. But at the same time, I do want to drill down with you a little bit about how we can't absolve ourselves of contemporary responsibility for the situation in places like Syria. I mean, you were, when you were Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, you were preparing for possible war in Syria. In retrospect, what should have been done differently to avoid the moment or moments that we've seen since then?
Yeah, it kind of depends, Magda, on how far back you want to wind the clock. So if you want to wind the clock all the way back to 9/11, I would say pretty strongly, not a news flash here, that the invasion of Iraq was the initial sin, if you will, that then unleashes the forces throughout this region. There were any number of ways we could have dealt with what was happening in Iraq. I think that degree, we have to look at ourselves and say that was a failure of the Bush administration. If you want to wind the clock back more recently, I would say under the Obama administration, it would have been the failure to enforce a red line after we saw Assad use chemical weapons against his troops. He was running torture chambers for children. And we had the opportunity then to go in, take out his Air Force. I think that would have potentially shifted events. So I think that one you have to say the Obama administration walked away at a moment when we could have gone in and perhaps changed the direction. Now we come to the Trump administration. Small deployment of troops. We're working with our allies. The U.S. involvement there is crucial with our Kurdish partners. We have beaten down the Islamic State. I would argue what we've done here potentially is snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So it just depends how far back you want to go. There's certainly plenty of missteps all around.
And so what now then, though, specifically in Syria? Mm-hmm. I mean, the president has made this declaration. U.S. troops are being pulled back. We're seeing, you know, the effects of Turkey crossing the Syrian border as we speak.
I'll give you three things we should be doing. I think we're doing some or part of various aspects of this. One is we need to put serious pressure, including economic sanctions, on Turkey so that they mitigate their behavior. They've clearly already crossed this Rubicon. They've invaded. But I think we can pressure them to stop perhaps as shallow as 5 miles from their border, and then work with us. And here's the second thing. After we put pressure on Turkey, we then offer the Turks, we will work with you for a NATO force. I mean, remember, this is a NATO border. Mm-hmm. We take a NATO force there that includes some Americans, but also includes other military personnel from the now 29 nations of NATO. And that becomes the entity that patrols that border and provides the separation between Turkey and what they perceive as, quote, Kurdish terrorists, unquote. And the third thing we should be doing is working more closely with our allies, partners, and friends in the region. And here it's the Arab states, the Gulf Arabs, Egypt, Jordan, and of course Israel, all of whom can be part of being a balance to that vacuum that Ray was talking about that's being created in the north. I think all of that will be infinitely harder now that we've withdrawn U.S. troops on the ground. I hope the president reverses that decision. And by the way, let's point out that decision is being condemned by Lindsey Graham and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. It's being condemned by Nancy Pelosi on one hand and Mitch McConnell on the other. The president really, truly ought to reverse course on this one. That would be a sign of character, the ability to change your mind.
Well, we are talking this hour with Admiral James Stavridis. He's got a new book out. It's called Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. We will be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Admiral James Stavridis. He's the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, a position he served in between 2009 to 2013, a retired 4-star Admiral of the United States Navy, and he's got a new book out. It's called Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. Let's go to Christopher, who's calling from Jewett City, Connecticut. Christopher, you're on the air.
Good day. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you ever looked into Admiral Hyman Rickover. I was in the submarine service for 23 years, and the man was a genius. He made sure that Electric Boat stayed in line, but the man's leadership skills, he was a bully. I watched officers turn into jelly every time you never know when he was going to show up. He berated some of the smartest men I have ever met. And I was wondering if you ever looked into him put in a book, or if you ever had any dealings with the man.
Christopher, the answer is yes to both counts. Of the 10 admirals, he is one of the 10. And the title of the chapter is The Master of Anger. The Master of Anger, because you are correct. Hyman Rickover presents this complicated picture. He was an extraordinary innovator. He invented the idea of nuclear power at sea. He drove it home. Our nuclear submarines, our nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, all date to Hyman Rickover. He was the longest-serving admiral in Navy history. But you are absolutely correct. He was a bully. He used anger very deliberately as a tool, and I think as a result, his legacy is flawed. And I think the lesson from Rickover, and I did meet him when I was a young midshipman. He was just a terrifying figure in every sense. And in the book, I talk about that encounter. Admiral Rickover accomplished great things, but he did it in a way that always had an undertone of anger and dissatisfaction. Now, his supporters would say that as a result of that anger, he caused people to work even harder and do more than they would have otherwise done. My own view is that it is seductive to use anger as a tool, but in the end, it's counterproductive over the long throw. So yes, looked at Rickover. Yes, I met with him, a complicated figure. The title of the chapter in the book is The Master of Anger. Mm. Thank you for raising him, Christopher.
Well, and Admiral Stavridis, you contrast Rickover with the complete opposite sort of leadership style in Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, also brilliant, who brought the Navy into sort of the computer age, but through mentorship and humility.
Indeed. Grace Hopper, in many ways, is kind of my favorite admiral. I mean, if I was going to go have a beer with one of these admirals, I'd probably pick Grace Hopper. I met her when I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy. I think she was captain at that point. She might have been recently promoted. But you've got it right. She pushed the Navy into the computer age. She, leaving aside the fact that she was a naval officer, she's seminal in computer science. Mm-hmm. She's among the very first people to come up with the idea of programming a computer. She's also responsible, Magna, for the term a bug, like you have a bug in the program, because she actually found a moth inside a big mainframe that she was working on during World War II. That's where the term comes from. And Grace Hopper was a tiny woman, very elegantly tailored, and she went around the country as a rear admiral giving speeches about being a trailblazer, being an optimist. She was a practical joker, incredibly likable person. Now, where Grace sort of did not do as well as she could have, I would say, is life balance. She was divorced early in her life. She never had another relationship. She devoted herself to her work. She devoted herself to the Navy. I think there's a lesson there about how to find balance in your life. But again, as the opposite of Rickover, 100% agree. We often say Rickover is the father of the nuclear Navy. Grace Hopper is the mother of the computer Navy. And all of our ships today are driven by the kinds of powerful computational systems that she brought to the Navy.
Wow. Well, let's go to Steve, who's calling from Orono, Maine. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is, so as leaders, and whether it's a CEO or an admiral, hold the vessel of righteousness, how where do you find that, so like you mentioned, your folks, your staff below you, you encouraged criticism and you could take criticism, whereas opposed we're looking at a president who I think tamps down criticism and thus we need whistleblowers. So what's the clue or the thread that makes great leaders to be able to create the environment that reaches down to the private mm-hmm. or reaches down mm-hmm. to the street, the people on the street who work for the leaders. That, to me, is just incredibly hard to understand, I think.
Well, Steve, thank you for that call and that question. Admiral Stavridis, go ahead.
I think, first of all, Steve has put his finger on one of the most important elements that drives success long term is that openness, that ability to absorb criticism. And yes, we should definitely focus on what criticism comes up from those who are on our team below us in rank. We should obviously be listening to our boss. I think an underrated source of hey, Jim, you may not be doing this quite right throughout my career were my peers. We are kind of focused on our chain of command vertically, we ought to look a little more horizontally. And I'll give you a practical example. When I was a young captain in command of a destroyer for the first time, we failed a big engineering inspection. We failed it so badly that we had to be towed back into port, which is a very humiliating experience for a ship. And I found that my crew stepped up to help turn it around. My boss gave me a second chance. But what really put the air under my wings again were my peers, who said, mm-hmm. you know, Jim, you failed here, but you've been a good captain. You can succeed. I think listening to your peers is an important element in this. And all of it, however, derives from what Steve pointed out to begin with, which is that ability to listen to those who are not yourself. The first and most important quality of any leader and the first buoy on the voyage of character is listening. It is listening to others.
Well, Admiral Stavridis, we've been avoiding the inevitable long enough. We have been having this conversation, and you've written this book through the prism and the context of leadership and character in 10 admirals that you've profiled here. So in a military context. And you say here at the end of the book that you learned that a handful of character traits were at the heart of both good character and effective leadership. And some of those traits include determination, perspective, a belief in justice, empathy, resilience, creativity, humility, and honesty. Do you believe the commander-in-chief, that President Donald Trump, has any of these characteristics?
I am one to believe that there is good in everybody, and I think the president is a mixture of qualities. And here what I'm going to say is each of us ought to be judging him, not as a human being, but as our president. And thus, I would encourage listeners, readers, voters to be thinking about the qualities that we can agree are important in anybody. And I think you walk through a number of those. And I think the president, in fairness, I think he has some creativity. I think he's demonstrating resilience. I think he is someone who is decisive, although he changes his mind frequently after being decisive. On the other hand, he doesn't show me much in the way of humility. He doesn't show me much in the way of balance. Honesty seems to be a challenge. Empathy, kind of non-existent. So as you look down those lists of qualities, and I would say, Magna, this applies not just to the president but to any of our elected officials. I think as voters, we need to put emphasis on these qualities of character. It's very easy, and I hear it a lot from people who say, well, I'm voting for this person. I don't really like them, but I kind of like their policies, and their policies are good for what I believe in. You know, that ought to be a component of your vote, but I would argue we are underweight in how we structure our thinking about those we elect to office, and we ought to do more thinking about character.
The president's demonstrating resilience in your mind. How?
I think a lot of people watching the floodgates of investigations come moving toward him. A lot of people, I think, by this point would have curled up in a fetal ball. Look at the cover of Time magazine last week where I write a column, and it's a picture of a caricature of the president kind of painting himself into a corner. I think in that sense, he is showing a desire to hit back and strike back. You and I may not agree at all with the targets he's choosing at this point. We may find him guilty of our own views of violating a host of things. But he is demonstrating resilience in continuing to chug along under extreme pressure.
Admiral Stavridis, I'm pursuing this because this really matters. I mean, you've written a book whose fundamental message is about the importance of character in leadership. And when we're talking about the commander-in-chief of the United States military, what effect do you think the lack of some of these character traits that you hold central to great leadership, what effect is that having down the ranks to the military?
I think it is a mixed picture. And if you really look at polling data, the president enjoys a high level of approval, higher than he does in the general public, with the military broadly, particularly among white enlisted men, which are the vast majority of the force. On the other hand, if you look at many of the things with which he's become involved in, for example, allegedly having affairs, paying off porn stars, those are the kind of things that would crack a military career. So it's a mixed and somewhat perplexing picture. What I find as I talk to active duty military is a very broad spectrum that runs from very discouraged at the moral component that they see as a failure to operational disagreements they have, for example, pulling the troops out of Syria. On the other hand, just as we see in American society broadly and our military reflects society, you see folks who are going to be 100% supportive of President Trump no matter what he does. So I'll close by saying back to character and how to evaluate the president or any elected official, I would say you have to think about it in a couple of different baskets. One is the character qualities we've been discussing. I think a second one is legal issues and how they turn out. And the third one are the policies. And then as a voter, you have to kind of balance those and decide, and this is the beauty of democracy, you have to decide which one matters the most to you. My brief for all who read this book, I hope, I'm carrying a case that we ought to think more about character and how it matters across the spectrum of those who step up to run for office in the United States.
Mm. Well, you don't get to close just yet because we still have 2.5 minutes here, so I'm going to get one more call in. Mark is calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Jim, thank you, Admiral Stravitis, for your extraordinary leadership. Thank you also for this incredible book on leadership and character. As you know, sir, this is Dr. Mark Mabry. I had the pleasure and honor of serving with you when you were SAC, you were as the former chief scientist of the Air Force. My question, Jim, is could you please give and share with other leaders your lessons learned on how to maintain humility? Such an incredibly successful career. What can we do as leaders across the nation, across the world, to maintain our humility so we can better serve others?
Great question. Great to hear your voice. I think first and foremost is what we've been talking about, and that is reading, speaking to others, listening. And I think in particular, reading the stories of others in history can help us ground ourselves. Secondly, that peer network that I talked about a moment ago, your peers will be the most honest with you of anyone. And third, and finally, I think it is for all of us to continue the act of service. You know, you and I are lucky to have served in the military. People will say to us, thank you for your service. There are so many ways to serve this country. Certainly our military. How about our diplomats, our CIA officers, our police, our firemen, our emergency technicians, nurses working in inner city clinics, school teachers in rural South Carolina, teaching packed classrooms for $37,000 a year. You think they're serving the country? I do. Peace Corps volunteers, volunteer for America, teach for America. Here's my point. I think the act of service, of encouraging others to serve, is the most grounding and central thing we can all do. And I would say to all who are listening and thinking about the voyage of character, build time to serve others into that voyage. It will reward you more than anything, and it will ground you more than anything.
Yeah. And you also talk about how just remembering how finite our lives are, that the horizon line will always be there, even if we're not. Well, Admiral James Stavridis, his new book is Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna. It's fun to talk about a book instead of current events, but next time I suspect we'll be talking more current events.
We got some in this time too, but definitely next time as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.